And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. We have a very special guest today. Mr. Peter Schweitzer is coming back to the show. He's been here before to talk to us about extortion and throw them all out, but he's actually topped himself this time with another great book entitled Clinton Cash. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be back on with you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. I got to tell you, you've certainly been making enough news lately. I can't turn on the television without seeing you, Peter.
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing. You know, you never know quite what kind of response you're going to get. I certainly knew that the Clinton camp was aggressively going to come after me, and you expect that. But the response, I think, from the media and from the public has been tremendous, so we're very excited.
Well, you should be. And one of the things I'd like to compliment you on right off the bat is that your books make a difference. I mean, going back to throw them all out, you were able to get them to change the rule, and now we don't have insider trading by Congress, although I think I read somewhere that you noted that perhaps what they passed has been watered down a little bit. Is that correct?
Yes, they have. You know, and this is why we need to constantly watch these guys. You know, if anybody has a doubt about, you know, a sin or the fallen nature of man or the fact that people are you know, capable of corrupt action, if they doubt any of those things, just spend some time in Washington, D.C., and you'll be quickly changed and corrected in your attitude. So yes, it's been watered down a little bit, but look, it's now to the point where I think people are watching the stock trades of their elected politicians. They have to disclose them, and it's harder to pull it off. People are now paying attention. The media is paying attention, and that's what I think, you know, ultimately is going to be the sentinel that keeps our country strong and keeps the republic strong, which is people holding their political leaders into account. We can pass lots of laws, but at the end of the day, we need to hold people into account by watching.
Well, you certainly did a good job of watching the Clintons in this book. You know, Peter, when I think of the Clintons, I think of Travelgate, Whitewater, cattle futures, Monica Lewinsky. I did not have sex with that woman. Women accusing Bill of rape, Bill's impeachment, Vince Foster, Ron Brown. I guess what I'm trying to say is that when I think of the Clintons, I already think of some people that I guess I've always thought were a little on the crooked side. So, and I know a lot of Tea Partiers who feel the same way. Were you surprised, based on what you know about the Clintons, with what you found, or was this over the top even for the Clintons?
I kind of found it over the top even for the Clintons. I mean, the stuff that happened in Arkansas, which obviously is important and significant and people need to know about, and the things that happened in the White House, the same thing, were kind of small ball compared to this. And you know, in terms of the amounts of money, the self-enrichment, I mean, we all remember the cattle futures story where, you know, Hillary turned $1,000 into $100,000. Well, you know, we're talking now about hundreds of millions of dollars. And we're talking about not, you know, some guy who had something before the state of Arkansas, but we're talking about, you know, some pretty shady, corrupt people in places like Africa and South America who, you know, in some cases have been convicted of crimes, who do business deals with warlords. I mean, it's on a scale and a scope that I think is unprecedented, for the Clintons.
Well, let me try to summarize the book a little bit for my listeners. Generally speaking, you started digging into matters and found that there seemed to be a correlation between donations to the Clinton Foundation or paying Bill Clinton a whole lot more for a speech than he was used to getting, and whether or not those same donors had important business that happened to be currently on the desk of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Is that a fair summary of what you discovered as you were digging into the Clintons?
Yes, and I would go even further and say that the people that were paying this money to the Clintons, either to the foundation or to Bill, and that had business on her desk at the State Department, often got favorable action from her. And in some cases, that actually required her to reverse her position on an issue. So this is, you know, sort of a pay to play. But what's interesting and I think troubling about this is, you know, I focus in the book really entirely on foreign companies and foreign businessmen. We're not talking about General Motors or Goldman Sachs. We are talking about, you know, foreign investors, foreign governments, and foreign businesses who are often competing against American companies or American firms. And the Clintons sided with those entities against American businesses because those foreign entities were paying them money.
A lot of money from what I read. And I have to say that the Clintons have always been pay to play. I mean, if you go back to, as you point out in the book, renting out the Clinton bedroom, effectively turning it into a bed and breakfast, if you will. People who made donations to the Clinton Library received favors. Frankly, if you paid enough money, you could receive a pardon before Clinton went out of office. So it's really nothing new for the Clintons to be pay to play, but they just sort of took it global.
Yeah, they took it global. And, you know, and what's strange is, and I think this speaks to, frankly, the sort of shameless nature of the way that they do this is, you know, you've got people connected with those past events that were so controversial that they continue to have, you know, strong financial ties to. You know, for example, you mentioned pardons. I mean, one of the most controversial things that Bill Clinton did was pardon Mark Rich, you know, on his last day in office. Mark Rich was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And you know, his ex-wife and others had paid money to the Clinton Foundation. Bill Clinton pardoned him, and it was condemned by everybody. I mean, even James Carville came out and said this was a really stupid thing to do. Well, as I point out in the book, one of the biggest financial supporters of the Clintons today is Mark Rich's business partner, a guy from Nigeria named Gilbert Chigori, who has, by the way, been convicted in Europe on money laundering and aiding and abetting a financial criminal enterprise. He helped the dictator of Nigeria smuggle billions of dollars out of the country and put them in Swiss bank accounts. But this is a guy who was widely known and reported to have been Mark Rich's business partner. And he's somebody that has pledged $1 billion with a B, $1 billion to the Clinton Global Initiative. He's given to the Clinton Foundation. He's paid for Bill Clinton's speeches. Bill Clinton invited him, and he attended Bill's 60th birthday party. And so they're like chums. And to me, that speaks to sort of the completely shameless nature with which they conduct their affairs and, frankly, how they don't really care what people think about the people that they hang around with. Because, again, the pardon of Mark Rich was one of the, you know, most condemned, universally condemned acts that he took. And here they are blatantly taking money and spending time socially with Mark Rich's business partner, who himself has a very troubling past.
You know, when Barack Obama's past started to come to light, people were critical of his relationships with Frank Marshall Davis, Tony Rezko, Reverend Wright, but that's really nothing compared to the people the Clintons hang out with.
Well, that's right. And I also think that, you know, fairly or unfairly, you know, people can look and say at somebody, well, you know, they were younger. Did they learn their lessons? You know, the people matured. We're talking the Clintons who have been on the national stage for, you know, for 20 years or more. We're talking about, you know, a couple that has, you know, faced a lot of controversy on precisely these kinds of issues. And yet they continue to do it. And, you know, they may have been dead broke when they left the White House, but they've made $130 million since then. And yet they can't seemingly help themselves. They continue, you know, to give speeches for people who have criminal pasts, who are very, very controversial, who wanted things from Hillary Clinton, and she gave them to him while she was Secretary of State. And, you know, it's the big question, I think the puzzling question is, why do they continue to do it? And I think part of it is that they frankly think that people aren't going to care, or they're going to be able to charm their way out of it.
Well, Bill did get away with the whole Monica Lewinsky thing in the sense that he wasn't removed from office, but he was impeached. But I guess they have some history of somehow slipping out of nasty situations, and it's been happening since Arkansas. Before we dig into some of these individual cases more specifically, I'd like to ask you, when did you first get the idea to dig into these specific types of things on the Clintons, and when did you realize that, wow, there's so much out here? I mean, we're not talking about an article. We're talking about an entire book.
Well, you know, I was interested in looking at the Clintons early last year because the two previous books I did, Throw Them All Out and Extortion, were about self-enrichment by politicians. I've always been puzzled and troubled by the fact that people go into public service, you know, their family member is in political office, or they are, and they, you know, go in relatively middle class and they come out fabulously wealthy. And I've always said, you know, there's a connection here, and it's wrong, and it's troubling, and it's going to attract even worse people to politics because they're going to have power and they're going to become rich at the same time. And so as I started looking at through that lens, and I finished these two books, you know, the Clintons immediately came to mind because there's no ex-president that has come even remotely close to collecting the kind of money and the amount of money as Bill Clinton has. And you know, that by itself, were his wife not a powerful senator and the Secretary of State at the same time, it would be a question of I don't really care. They're private citizens. They're entitled to do what they want to do. Every president since Eisenhower has done this, so let him go do it. The problem is, of course, that his wife was a powerful senator and was the Secretary of State. And then the question becomes, was that connected to his wealth accumulation? Certainly not all of it. All presidents come out and write a memoir and give some speeches. But when you start to look at how Bill's speaking fees spike dramatically once she becomes Secretary of State, this is 8 years after he's left office. Suddenly, people overseas are offering him three times or more what he usually gets paid, and he's taking it. And the flow from the to the Clinton Foundation from people who previously were not interested in giving, and suddenly they're lining up with a pledge of $100 million, and they've got things going on in Africa and elsewhere where they need the Secretary of State on their side, I just immediately knew there was a troubling story here. And I think one of the big turning points in the research came pretty early, which was when we discovered that, you know, Hillary is a condition for taking the job. Barack Obama insisted that she, every year, she and her husband disclose all the contributors to the Clinton Foundation, a very basic, simple requirement. And we found in Canadian tax records that, in fact, there were multi-million dollar contributors that they were not disclosing and that they started violating the agreement almost immediately. That's when I knew we had something big here, because basically the rule in Washington, D.C. is if you're hiding something, it's because you have something to hide.
The Clintons were not exactly straightforward. Not only did they, according to your book, not only did they leave people off the list, but they had different ways of putting people on the list that sort of covered who the real donor actually was.
No, that's a great point. That's a hugely great point, because the problem with disclosure and the reason that President Obama insisted on it, and the reason the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you know, insisted on it, and the reason that Bill Clinton publicly came out and said we're going to have complete transparency, is precisely because people need to know who's giving you money. And the problem is they kept people off the list. You know, for example, this chairman of a Russian government-owned uranium company gave more than $2 million, and that was not disclosed. But you also have a case of somebody like Amar Singh, who is an Indian politician who wanted something from Hillary Clinton, who is listed as a donor of between $1 million and $5 million. But when you talk to Amar Singh, he says, it's not my money. I didn't give them any money. And so you have this huge problem now that there is no transparency, that even where they are allegedly listing donors, you don't know if that's really the ultimate source of the funds. And frankly, the Clinton Foundation doesn't seem to be particularly interested or care to get to the bottom of it, which, of course, leads us back to what I said before, which is if you are hiding something, it's because you probably have something to hide.
I think Barack Obama said something like that early on when he hit the national stage. My thought about Hillary Clinton being Secretary of State while Bill was collecting these enormous fees and while the Clinton Foundation was raking in these even larger donations, as you said, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, is that there was criticism and concern, according to your book, about Hillary Clinton taking the position that came from both sides of the political aisle before she actually took office. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I mean, when she was before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, she had not only Richard Lugar, the highly respected Republican senator from Indiana, who nobody would accuse of being an aggressive partisan, but she also had John Kerry, from Massachusetts, who is now the Secretary of State under President Obama, saying the same thing. And when Richard Lugar raised questions about why are you even taking foreign money, John Kerry said, you know, he's speaking not just for his side of the aisle, he's speaking for our side of the aisle. So this was universally recognized as a problem. And I think anybody with, you know, two pieces of common sense would recognize it's a problem when the chief diplomat, the person that's architect of our foreign policy, when their family and their husband is taking large payments from foreign entities, there's a problem here. And the Clintons agreed to the solution of complete transparency, and they couldn't even live up to that. And by the way, you know, when you look at the donations that were rolling in, they started violating that agreement almost immediately. They signed that agreement with Barack Obama in late 2008. Those first donations that they never disclosed started rolling in early 2009. So they didn't even skip a beat. And to me, it's kind of baffling for President Obama and for the people around him, that they don't seem to, at least publicly, have, you know, much of a concern or have raised a ruckus about how poorly he has been treated by the Clintons. Because essentially what they said is, you know, you go off in the corner and you know, you be a good president, and we're going to be the adults and do what we want to do. That's basically how they treated him. And to me, it's an astonishing display of arrogance.
Well, it's not that often that I defend President Obama, but it appears in this instance he tried to do the right thing, but the Clintons just wouldn't have any part of it. As I read through your book, there were two cases in particular that offended me greatly, because all of the cases were offensive. But in these two instances, I felt like the Clintons were willing to compromise American national security for money. And the first one of those cases was the case of the Russian uranium. I mean, basically, the Russians now, according to your book, control 50% of America's uranium output. And now that they control that uranium, they've got extra uranium that they can give to people like Iran. So give a little background on that particular story, and then give me your own assessment of how they've compromised America's security by doing that.
Oh, well, the story begins in 2005 in Kazakhstan. Bill Clinton is in that Central Asian country with a Canadian investor named Frank Giustra. And Frank Giustra wants these very lucrative uranium mining concessions in the country. The country's ruled by this corrupt dictator named Nazarbayev. And both Bill and Hillary Clinton take actions to pressure the Kazakhs to give that concession to Giustra. Hillary Clinton's a powerful member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and according to Kazakh officials, she tells them, unless you give this concession to this Canadian businessman, I will not meet with you anymore. And that matters because Kazakhstan gets substantial amounts of money from the U.S. government through the Armed Services Committee for nonproliferation issues. Bill Clinton goes to Kazakhstan to meet with Nazarbayev along with Giustra and praises his leadership, even though he's a dictator, says what a wonderful man he is, that he's got a great human rights policy. After he does that, Frank Giustra gets the uranium concessions, and a few weeks after that, Frank Giustra, coincidentally, the Clintons would say, decides to send $31 million to the Clinton Foundation. Now, the entity that now has these uranium concessions from Kazakhstan, based in Canada, becomes this company called Uranium One. Mm-hmm. Uranium One starts buying uranium assets in the United States, large amounts of them in places like Wyoming and Utah and Texas and Arizona. And then, lo and behold, this catches the interests of the Russian government, Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin has long wanted to try to corner the uranium market because he thinks it's a expression of Russian power and it will give them control and influence over other countries. At this point in time, the Russians decide that they want to buy the company. For that to happen, the federal government, a number of government agencies, including Hillary Clinton's State Department, have to sign off on the deal. It's at this point that eight other investors that are involved, we talked about Frank Giustra, eight other investors decide to send a combined more than $100 million to the Clinton Foundation. And after that happens, lo and behold, Hillary Clinton signs off on the transfer of this uranium to the Russian government. Now, what's unusual about this is of all the people at the top of government agencies that look at this, Hillary Clinton is the only one that has a reputation in the past of opposing precisely these kinds of deals, where a foreign government wants to come in and buy a critical industry. But in this case, she decides to let the thing go through and pass, which you know is a very, very troubling transaction. And you know, if you saw one example like that, you might say, okay, well, is this coincidence? Is there something else? The problem is that pattern gets repeated whether you go to India, whether you go to Colombia, whether you go to parts of Africa, whether you go to Haiti. It's the same pattern over and over and over again. And I think that's what is the power of the book, and I think what is so troubling, and I think the reason the Clintons are so concerned about the book.
This particular instance with the Russian uranium is one that a lot of people have used to sort of criticize the book, and they've said, well, she was one of a lot of people that had to sign off on this. Everybody else did, you know, because she was only one of a great number of people, why would they give her this money simply to get her vote when there were so many other people whose vote they needed? But those people, if I'm reading the book right, kind of missed the point, because she had a long history of opposing this and then suddenly changed her mind once large amounts of money began flowing to her husband, Bill, and to the Clinton Foundation. Is that a good way to summarize it?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I would add to that that it's not just about the final approval of the Uranium One deal. There's a whole history of the Russians wanting to purchase this and discussions with the United States that we're not privy of. Because the thing you got to remember is this is all taking place in 2009 and 2010. Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State, and she is the point person on the so-called Russian reset. She's the one that's having the private meetings with Putin and the foreign minister Lavrov. She's the one negotiating with the Russian government on the so-called A123 nuclear cooperation agreements. She's the one that is at the center of this entire U.S.-Russian relationship. So she has an enormous role to play. The problem is we don't have access to know precisely what discussions were held on this, first of all, because you know, you've got this privileged diplomatic communication, but also you've got these 30,000 missing emails. So it's not just a question of you know, having these government agencies sign off on the deal. How this was crafted, how it got to the point where the Russians knew that they could put in a bid to buy this and it would be approved, all that backstory involves Hillary Clinton because she is the point person on the Russian reset.
Well, I believe a lot of people just sort of guessed that the 30,000 emails must have had to do with Benghazi. But after reading your book, it seems to me that she had a whole lot more that she needed to hide.
and listen, I've always thought, you know, Benghazi is an important issue. It's sort of a microcosm issue of something that happened over a series of days, and it had disastrous consequences. But I don't think that explains the full 30,000 emails. And I think a lot of those 30,000 emails have to do precisely with the kinds of transactions and self-enrichment that we're talking about in the book.
The other case that I felt compromised national security was her treatment of India. And after reading what you had to say about that, I felt like her treatment of India, and, you know, of course, they really ticked Bill Clinton off when they tested their own nukes. But when you look at that, it had the potential to basically break up the nuclear proliferation treaty and the people who were party to that, did it not?
Yes, that's exactly right. And again, this was a long-held position of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton to support the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Indian government wanted access to U.S. nuclear technology. Hillary was initially opposed to that. But then there was the flow of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation and speaking gigs for Bill Clinton. And then, lo and behold, in 2008, she reverses course. And now is suddenly in favor of the deal. And there's a person very closely associated with them called Sant Chatwal, who is a Indian who lives in the United States. And Sant Chatwal in 2010 actually wins an award from the Indian government. And according to the Indian government, he basically got that award because he got Hillary Clinton to change her mind on the issue. And when Sant Chatwal was asked in India, how did you get her to change her mind on this issue, his response was, well, I spent millions of dollars to get this deal through. So, you know, all the evidence is there. And again, I think what's so troubling about this is we are used to, you know, at the State Department, you know, somebody getting appointed an ambassador to France because they gave a lot of money to a president. That kind of thing happens. We know that.
Sure.
But here we're talking about nuclear policy. Something very fundamental to national security, and it's basically being sold off.
Absolutely unbelievable. There are times on the air when you kind of have to fake it because, you know, we try to make radio exciting. In this case, Peter, I mean, I'm just sitting in front of my microphone getting absolutely sick that two people would compromise the national security of the United States for money when, quite frankly, it's obvious they already have more money than anybody could possibly need. It's as if they're insatiable when it comes to raising money, and they don't care what they have to do to get it. Now, you point out in this book that it really isn't a left-wing, right-wing kind of issue where we should be fighting each other on this. People on both parts of the political aisle, on both sides of the political aisle, were opposed to this before she took the position of Secretary of State. And when you look at some of the things that she's done in order to get money, and Bill, let's not leave him out, they don't care. You know, how many times have you heard liberals crying about human rights violations? They'll do business with people who violate human rights on a daily basis in order to make money. Their liberals seem to care greatly about the environment. Not that conservatives don't, but liberals seem to be more outspoken about it. And you look at some of the deals that she did. I mean, basically going into these third world countries and raping them for their natural resources. And she absolutely has no problem with that. So, what do you think the result's going to be? Is she going to be able to win the primaries and head into the general election? Or is it possible that, you know, liberals who quite frankly don't like big corporations and seem to be almost offended by money and capitalism might actually take a look at her and say she's damaged goods and we better put somebody else in the general election? What are your thoughts? I mean, I know it's speculation and it's early, but what do you think?
Well, I think that there's an interesting dynamic to the book that doesn't fit into the kind of left-right spectrum. And part of that is the response from the book. I mean, obviously people who are conservative and who don't like Hillary Clinton have embraced the book because they feel like it confirms what they've always kind of had suspicions about with the Clintons or have known. But I also think that those on the political left have embraced the book as well because they see very troubling behavior here. That's why you have a guy like Larry Lessing, who's a professor at Harvard Law School, no conservative by any stretch, has said, look, you read this book and there's no other way to read it other than corruption. And there are a number of other progressives, Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia University, saying that, you know, when it comes to Haiti and Reconstruction and some of the things I talk about in the book, that he saw it and that this has always been troubling to people. So this doesn't fit well into the left-right divide, and I think that's one of the reasons that Clintons are so upset about it.
Hillary Clinton is famous for not answering questions when she doesn't want to answer them. Do you think that there is any way that she'll be able to get through the election process and escape having to answer some of the questions that you raised in this book?
I don't think so. I mean, the way that I think of it is that, you know, voters have a lot of common sense, at least a lot of them do. And if she's asking to be the leader of the free world, the person that's going to stand up to Vladimir Putin, the person that's going to, you know, deal with terrorism, she should be able to spend 60 minutes talking to the national media about the flow of money to her family and her foundation. If she can't do that, how on earth is she going to deal effectively with these kinds of challenges?
Well, you know, Peter, there's so many things that we didn't get a chance to get into. You know, Nigeria, the Sudan, more detail on Ethiopia. We could talk all day about this stuff. But I would suggest that for anyone who wants to get a clear picture of what the Clintons are all about, and when I say anyone, I mean anyone on either side of the political aisle, Clinton Cash has to be one of the best researched books I've ever read. And I'm a fan of yours, Peter. I'm not just saying that because you're on the air. I remember reading the book, Do As I Say, Not As I Do, Profiles in Liberal Hypocrisy. And that was one of the books that really sort of opened my eyes to what really goes on amongst people of wealth and people with great political power. But somehow, all these books later, you have continued to top yourself each time. And it's not an easy task because you write very well. But this book may very well be your best book yet. So for people who really want the inside scoop on what the Clintons are all about, the types of things they'll do simply to get money either for themselves or their foundations, I would say pick up a copy of Clinton Cash, The Untold Story of How and Why Foreign Governments and Businesses Helped Make Bill and Hillary Rich. Great book,
right.
Fantastic read. I couldn't put it down. I often don't have time to read the entire book before a guest comes on, but I certainly made sure that happened this time because, again, once you get it in your hands, you don't want to put it down. Peter,
well, thank
for coming
so
on the show. No, you're more
thanks
than
so
welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and, you know, go out, expose some more corruption, and come back, and we'll do it again.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot.
Thank
Bye.
You, Peter. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillard.